The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of
auto, home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you
to discover the difference at
necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system,
improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at
imagine.d-h.org.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Here's a surprising statistic. More murders were solved by police departments in 1995 than were committed in 2014. So on one hand, that's a good thing. The number of murders and violent crimes in general have gone down significantly in the past 20 years. On the other hand, the percentage of murders being solved has not improved. The question is why, given the lighter caseloads, more precise forensics, and more tools to follow a criminal's digital footprint? At a time when mistrust between police and citizens clashed in many of the nation's communities, Dara Lind looked into how those tensions may affect the rate of homicides being solved. She's a staff writer for Vox who covers criminal justice. And Dara Lind, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me on.
So violent crimes have been dropping over the past 25 years. How significantly?
The violent crime rate has basically fallen in half since the early 1990s. Over the 80s and 90s, it was incredibly high. People were very worried about it. That's where you have the war on drugs, war on crime, crack epidemic fears. And then quietly throughout the 1990s, without a whole lot of people really, even in the, academic and policy world realizing it, it started what's now become a quarter century long trend. And it was really until the turn of the century that academics started taking it seriously. And even now, with about 15 to 20 years of research into why crime has gone down, there isn't really a clear explanation as to how much of it is changes in how police operate, whether putting more people in prison really did bring crime down, whether it's things like the economy or stuff totally out of left field, like reducing lead in paint. It's a massively important social phenomenon that no one fully understands, even as it's continued.
Well, we should note, as you do in your article, that there has been a sharp jump in homicide rates in 2015 in several big cities. Any theories as to why that may be?
In the same sense that it took several years to figure out that there's been a 25-year decline in crime, a lot of academics are really wary of saying, oh, there's this big spike that must mean that crime is on the rise again. No one can quite yet say whether this is just what you would call noise in the data and weird, strange things happen to be happening, or whether there really is something that's connecting these cities and that might portend for a continued increase in violent crime. Some of the theories that have been thrown out are pretty clearly politically motivated. On the one hand, you have people saying that because of recent protests over police treatment of young black men, people no longer trust police, and therefore criminals know they can operate with impunity. You have people, on the other hand, saying that police don't care about policing communities, and therefore criminals are coming in and filling the gap. Both of those seem a little bit more politically motivated than motivated by facts, but it's definitely the case that a lot of cities that never really saw quite as much of a decline in violent crime as the rest of the country did have seen a spike back up in 2015.
But you do write about the relationship between policing and community. Baltimore is an example where in the early 1990s, 70% of murder cases ended in arrests, while 2014 only 45% did. Now, this is a city that went through a lot of turmoil and a lot of scrutiny this year. What's your takeaway of that?
So this is really tricky because at the macro level, it's really tempting to say any change in crime rates is because of a change in policing. And because there's so much else that goes into crime, and it's such a more complicated social phenomenon than just a criminal justice phenomenon, that's almost always an overstatement. But then at the micro level, when you look at what goes into solving individual crimes and how does solving individual crimes impact whether people are likely to trust the police and go to them in the future, that there's a really strong connection. The Baltimore Sun, actually, its police department invited reporters to come embed with them in a homicide investigation because reporters there had been very dismissive of how police were acting toward the community. And the police said, if you don't think we're doing a good job, come with us and we're going to show you how hard it is. And what they reported at the end of last year was totally consistent with what people who have done other reporting on homicides in major cities have shown, that people know in the community know who committed the murder, and they don't talk to the police about it because they're afraid of retaliation from the murderers or the murderer's accomplices. They don't believe that the police are capable of protecting them, and they believe that the police are more interested in busting them for minor offenses than they are in busting people who kill members of their community. And that's not just something that you see consistently when people do reporting all over the country, but it's something that you see when there are analyses of how do you solve a murder case. Two of the most important variables are being able to talk to a reliable witness at the crime scene and being able to go around and talk to the victim's friends and family and, you know, colleagues and any of that. Those are two of the factors that are most highly correlated with finally being able to crack the case. And when you don't have people who are willing to talk to you because they simply don't feel that it's worth it to their personal safety, then it's extremely difficult to be able to make any progress, even in a case where you know that everyone who's talking to you knows what who did it and won't tell you.
Well, so eye-opening, given, you know, all that we've heard about how forensics and DNA evidence and cell phones and GPS, you know, the kind of following the digital footprint of criminals, all of these things in the law enforcement toolkit. But you're saying that it goes back to community relationships.
Right. I think when you're talking about policing, it's useful to remember that police have to do two things. They have to both solve crimes that have occurred and prevent future crimes from occurring. And at the most, you know, 10,000-foot level, most police departments have made the decision that preventing crimes is a more efficient use of their resources than solving them. The other thing is that ballistics and forensics are useful, but they're not everything. And, you know, if you talk to lawyers, once a case goes to court, they'll joke about the CSI effect, where a lot of people who aren't familiar with the criminal justice system assume that every case is going to have clear physical evidence that's going to tell us exactly who did it. And often that's not true.
We're speaking with Dara Lind. She covers criminal justice for Vox and has looked into why, when there are fewer murders being committed now than in the past 20 or 25 years, fewer of these cases actually get solved or cleared. Well, Dara, how many murders do end in arrest?
The general clearance rate is somewhere around 60 to 65%. That's going to vary depending on whether you're talking about a large or small police department. The biggest cities actually have, they're at the higher end of that range, and then medium-sized and small cities tend to be a little bit lower. That varies across cities tremendously. In Baltimore, even before this past year when it's been terrible, the clearance rate for homicides was fewer than 50%. And that's a big change from 25 years ago when there were many more homicides happening, but many more of them were getting cleared. Nationally, as the homicide rate and the violent crime rate have dropped, the clearance rate has stayed pretty flat. About 60% of homicides got cleared, which means somebody got fingered for them, or they just determined that the murderer was killed, so there wasn't anyone to arrest for the case anyway. In 1990, about 60% of homicides are getting cleared in 2015. That means that obviously more homicides by number got cleared in 1990 because there were more homicides happening.
Is it really surprising that the percentage of murders that are solved hasn't changed? I mean, it makes sense given that there are fewer murders. Police are solving fewer murders.
There's certain argument out there that as murder rates have gone down, the murders that have remained are in the neighborhoods and social contexts that were always going to be the hardest to be to police anyway. And because of that, you know, it makes perfect sense that we're not solving the same, you know, the same crimes that wouldn't have been solved 25 years ago aren't being solved now. I think the strongest argument against that is places like Baltimore, where you really did have a big drop in the number of homicides that were getting cleared. The other argument against it is that homicide detectives who were working during this period, especially in the really big cities, were so overwhelmed by cases that it was honestly a miracle that they got through those years. It's the amount of strain on urban police departments was so ridiculous that if you compare it to now where they're getting so many fewer cases across the transom, yeah, it's kind of insane that with so much more time to be able to devote to a case, that doesn't mean anything in terms of progress. Mm. Or, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean that more cases are going to get solved. I think it's also like the most crime trends have not been as flat over the last 25 years as this has. Right. More people have been getting arrested. More people were getting arrested for murder from 1990 to 2000. And then after 2000, arrest rates per murders dropped. That changed more than clearance rates did. The number of people who got arrested for murder who got convicted rose consistently, as it did for every crime, over the last 25 years. There definitely are changes in how these things are being investigated and prosecuted, but clearance rates are the one thing that is staying stubbornly consistent.
Caseloads at police departments may have diminished somewhat, but community scrutiny is certainly amped up, especially in metropolitan areas. And municipalities and police departments are working really hard to improve the relationships between the communities and the police, between police departments and the communities that they're supposed to be serving. So where do you think this is going, Dara? Do you think the trend is showing that cases are going to be solved with community help more in the future?
If you're trying to figure out whether police are going to be able to rebuild trust with communities, looking at homicide clearance rates is probably not going to be the first thing that changes, right? That's probably going to be something that changes as a result of a lot of other issues getting solved first. And there's not a clear answer to how you rebuild community trust. It seems very obvious that doing things wrong for either a short or long amount of time can destroy community trust very quickly. There isn't as much evidence as to how that improves again. And even if you have, you know, leadership that is very invested in changing the relationship between the police and the community, actually turning that into an institutional priority when you have police who have been told for, you know, a couple of decades that the things that are most important are the things that can be quantified, which are arrests. That kind of culture clash is something that is not new to this particular issue, and I don't think it's something that's going to get immediately fixed.
Well, Dara Lind, thank you for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Dara Lind, she's staff writer at Vox, where she covers criminal justice, and you can find a link to read her article and a lot of infographics that show you a little more about this picture. The article is called Police Are Solving a Lot Fewer Murder Cases Than They Used To. Link is at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Officials in New Hampshire estimate that the number of deaths due to drugs surpassed 400 by the end of 2015. That's about 1 in 3,000 residents. And while the numbers are shocking, it is the lives and the families behind those numbers that Anne-Marie Zanfania, an artist from Plastow, is focusing on. When Anne-Marie lost her 25-year-old daughter, Jacqueline, in October of 2014, the first line of her obituary in the local paper made it plain. Jackie died from an accidental overdose after being sober for 11 months. Anne-Marie refused to be shamed by the disease of addiction, and after struggling to get through the following 6 months, channeled her anger and sadness into a project that has helped other families cope with loss. She began painting portraits of young people killed by drug overdoses in the state, and she's brought several in to show us. They are vibrant, colorful, and beautiful. And Anne-Marie, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you very much.
You can tell me as much as you'd like to of this, but I'm looking at this portrait of your daughter, Jacqueline. Jacqueline, beautiful young woman. What happened to her?
She was beautiful, no doubt about it. And she knew it. But I think when she was younger, she was maybe struggling with behavioral issues that never got addressed. Although I brought her to many doctors, psychiatrists, in counseling, out of counseling, her whole life. And I tried to get her into a rehab, but she wasn't ready. And I found out about almost maybe 9 months before she died that she was taking heroin. Mm-hmm. And we had a family intervention. Mm-hmm. I asked her to move out because she was having none of it. And she did. But we keep in touch because I always kept her cell phone on. And then she moved back home again. And things were going really well. She got a job. She got a new car and a new boyfriend. We thought, life is good. Right. We thought our prayers are answered. But it had been a difficult struggle, you know, because when you have a child that is on drugs, there's lots of other things you deal with.
Right.
You deal with the police. You deal with your own possessions. Where are they?
Yeah, I've heard a lot about that kind of thing.
And it's sad. But I went to, I'd been going to a therapist when, well, before Jackie overdosed the first time. And I had been grieving Jackie for that whole year before she died. Because I know that if you take heroin, you usually die.
And she was lost to you, I guess, on some level anyway, if she's addicted.
Right. And the therapist, you know, was explaining to me that the brain chemistry changes yes. totally. And that's something I think a lot of people don't understand. But I had that explained to me so that I could, you know, make some sense of what was going on.
So it felt more like a disease than a moral failing, which I think is what a lot of people get upset about, you know, that they think that somehow they failed, that it's not about brain chemistry and drugs answering an addiction.
Well, I knew it wasn't that. You know, we have a good family, a good support system. She was raised well and had, you know, whatever basically she wanted.
How old was she when she died?
She was 25.
Oh, I'm so sorry. So you started with her portrait, making
yes.
her portrait. Did you plan on doing others at that time?
No.
How many have you done now?
I'm working on my sixth one.
Well, I'm looking at, you brought them in, and you're generous to bring them in for us to see them, but I'm just struck at how young, vibrant. I mean, obviously you're taking portraits of pictures that are, you know, people posing for them. They want to look good. How did you choose these subjects?
I met parents
yeah.
or wives or loved ones, and they got me a picture. Sometimes I can pull pictures off of Facebooks because to do this, I put the original picture through a computer program,
mm-hmm.
and it comes out with color and the shape. And then I draw it and paint it.
Mm-hmm. You do the shading. They're very, if I can use the word, kind of Warholian. You know, there's
yes.
there's not a lot of shading distinction, very bold kind of colors.
Well, it's called posterization.
Mm-hmm. Right. I'm wondering, you know, as you're doing these portraits of these people, you may not have known them at all. What's going through your mind?
The pain of their family. My pain, it doesn't go away, but I feel like I'm bringing attention right now to the problem, and that's a mission of mine.
Mm.
Also, it helps the family members heal a little better, because it's not your regular portrait. This is a joyful painting because of the colors I choose and and so they have something that would make them happy.
The response here in New Hampshire and other places, some talk of policy changes, some talk of recovery centers, you know, getting tighter on fentanyl. What role does art play in this discussion of the heroin crisis?
Art brings attention. You see people here, even though they're brightly colored. These are all our children. And when you put a face to a statistic, I think it makes a big difference. This is not just number, 300 that died. This is a person. Someone who had a mother and a father, or children, you never know. And we have to honor them. Something terrible happened to them, and they died from heroin. And I don't want to let Jackie die, This keeps her with me. It keeps us with their families.
Well, it's an overwhelmingly moving thing to see. And Anne-Marie, I just want to thank you so much for coming all this way and bringing them with you.
You're welcome.
Anne-Marie Zanfania, she's a New Hampshire-based artist. She's begun painting portraits of people who have died due to drug overdoses here in the state. You can see photographs of some of her portraits at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. For a time, Glenn David Andrews was one of the musicians you just had to see perform if you visited New Orleans. The singer and trombonist song known as Roll With Me is a staple among brass bands. You'd see him playing his horn at funerals or second-line parades or leading a rotating crew of musicians at local clubs. Well, after a few unhinged gigs and lengthening rap sheet over scrapes with the law and drug and alcohol offenses, it looked like Glenn David Andrews was running out of road. Like his storm-ravaged city, he needed help. Glenn found a route to recovery in rehab. It is in his music that he is finding redemption.
Daddy's on the corner, shooting dice. Mama's in the kitchen, making beans and rice. Walk through the river, swim through the flood. Took a feather from a bald head eagle, jumped back, woo, drank panther blood. Life is like a mockery, dope deals and robberies.
That's the song New York to NOLA by Glenn David Andrews. He's going to be coming to the Music Hall in Portsmouth on January 17th. We spoke with him in 2014 when his latest album, Redemption, first came out. Glenn David Andrews, a pleasure to speak with you.
Good morning, sweetheart. How you feeling?
I'm feeling just great. Really happy to talk to you. You grew up in Tremaine, and this is the neighborhood that is kind of a crucible for New Orleans music and that inspired the HBO series called Tremaine. Do you remember first hearing or thinking or seeing music and thinking, that's what I want to do?
I remember watching Olympia Brass Band early as 4 years old, and I knew that I would be a part of the Olympia Brass Band, and I grew up. It was in 1997 when I officially joined the Olympia Brass Band, and that's still one of the oldest brass bands in New Orleans. I watched the original Tuxedo Jazz Band, which is the oldest institution in jazz, and I grew up to be a member of that band, so I've always wanted to be a musician, and I've been lucky enough to only have had one small job in my life. Other than that, I've only played music and traveled, so I knew this is what I was supposed to do.
But tell us a little bit about what got you to Redemption. It sounds like you were sinking downward at the same time that New Orleans, after Katrina, after the flood, was trying to rise out of the muddy water. What got you to rehab?
D-R-U-G-S. Drugs. Well, it gets most people to rehab.
Well, but you've been doing drugs for a while and been coping with it. Why finally decide that it's time?
Well, we all go through stuff, and at one point you get an opportunity to be able to really look at yourself and decide if you want to be something better than what you are. I never thought I was a bad person. I did a lot of very great, successful things in the midst of an addiction, but it gets to a point where you have to put the brakes on. And right now, I think I'm creating the best music I've ever done in my life. I'm more happier than I've ever been in a long time. So it was more than just a bunch of reasons. When you're dealing with addiction, you're dealing with a lot of selfishness. You're becoming real selfish. And you're not looking at the impact that it has on your mother, your sister, your brother, your nieces, your nephews. And today I'm a better son. I'm a way, always was a cool uncle, but I'm way cooler as an uncle now. My brother and Rebirth Brass Band, we have a great relationship. Me and my sister are best friends. And I'm single and happy. And right now, I wouldn't trade that for all the silver and gold in the world.
You're also a born showman. You know, I've seen you play in small clubs, and also our senior producer saw you at Jazz Fest, put on an amazing show. That requires a kind of bravado, and I think recovery requires a kind of humility. It can't be an easy place, New Orleans, on stage to be sober.
It's never an easy place, but it's an everyday struggle. I'm not perfect by a long shot. I won't sit here and act like I am perfect. But I do understand that where I was at almost two and a half years ago is not where I ever want to be again in my life. But like any other addict or any other person that deals with recovery, it's called one day at a time. And that's the only way I figure that I can deal with it. I don't really know what's going to happen tomorrow, but I know just for the day and just for right now, I'm happy, I'm sober, and I'm going to the bodega and buy tennis after this. So I don't really have much to complain about. Just one day at a time. And I didn't get here by myself. It was a real host of people that really loved me for who I am, not what I am.
Well, let's hear a little bit more from Redemption. This is the song Surrender that has some of that language of recovery in it.
Every morning when I wake up, I surrender all of my fears, all my trials, tribulations, higher power, take them away. As the day goes long, everything seems to go wrong. Surrender, and the battle's not yours. The fight's already been won. Yes, it has. Surrender. Carry the weight. Don't ever lose the faith. No.
We're listening to the song Surrender. It's from the new CD Redemption by the New Orleans musician and bandleader Glenn David Andrews, who's our guest. Now, it's hard to explain to a New Hampshire audience what a New Orleans kind of free-form show sounds like, looks like. I've seen you get up on tables, walk around with the crowd. What is it about interacting with the crowd that makes a difference for you as a performer?
Well, I have ADD and I can't keep still. No, I feel the music. I just got to be honest with you. There's four or five times a week I perform, and there's two times a week, besides like right now doing an interview, when I really get to live my dream. And my dream is up on that stage with those lights shining on me. And for 3 hours, I get to pretend that I'm Louis Armstrong in 2014. I get to imagine that I'm a happy person, which I am, and I'm grateful to do what I'm doing. For those 3-4 hours, I might jump, I might shout, I might clap, because that's what I feel. I'm not doing that just so people can say, oh, wow, he got up on tables. You know, I'm 6'4". I got to be careful getting up on tables with that's wet. Crowd surfing at 200 pounds ain't easy, but when you feel it, man, and I feel the music. It's like I just enjoy what I do.
Well, you, besides carrying on in the tradition of Louis Armstrong, also Mahalia Jackson, even on this very record, you pick up from one of her songs, Didn't It Rain? Let's hear a bit from that.
Oh, yeah.
Well, it rained 40 days, 40 nights without stopping. Noah was glad when the rain stopped dropping. Knocked on the window, knocked at the door. Cried, Brother Noah, take some more. Noah cried, Noah, full of sin. God's got the key. Just listen, how it's raining. Well, listen, how it's raining. All day, all night. Just listen, how it's raining. Some morning.
That's Glenn David Andrews singing in his very own way one of the traditional songs of Mahalia Jackson, the gospel great from New Orleans. I think listening to this record, a lot of us get reminded of this idea of, like, coming through the storm. I mean, I remember hearing this expression once, like,
Religious people are afraid of hell, but spiritual people have already been there. So you're carrying on in some kind of spirit. You kind of been through hell, and I wonder, if you hadn't, would you have made this record? Or what kind of record would you be making?
You know, the reality of that question is, if you don't get yourself together, you're not going to do really. You're not going to be successful in life. You know, the only thing to that is an Amy Winehouse ending, people like that that's really talented that never get it. You know, the Michael Jackson endings, the overdoses, the dying. That's the reality of that. No, I don't have time to sit around and pretend like that's not the reality of what would have happened. And in life, you have to go through your own personal storms. And my storms is not over. Right now, I'm just going through a good season. Maybe in a few years from now, I might have financial trouble. I might have health trouble. But when you're surrounded by people that love you and you really know, reach out and say, I need help, there's not really much you can't overcome. Like, I really believe that.
Glenn David Andrews, I want to thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Anytime, and hopefully we get to hang out in New Orleans. I could take you by Kermit and get some barbecue.
And that was my earlier conversation with the musician and band leader Glenn David Andrews. He's at the Music Hall in Portsmouth this Saturday, January 17th. There's links to more information on the show and his 2014 album, Redemption, at wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up, a look at the unnamed vacant lots and median strips and other forgotten pieces of the urban landscape. That's when Word of Mouth continues.
Body ride. It puts hope on me.
Oh, chariot.
Your golden way. I'm walking down upon this faith.
Oh, chariot.
I'm singing out loud to guide me. Give me your strength.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. When you drive through most U.S. cities, a particular aspect of the landscape goes largely unnoticed. These are the vacant lots and median strips and tiny triangles of land in urban environments that are side effects of the automobile age. In the city of Baltimore, these overlooked, nameless public spaces have become the passion project for one man who's giving them a name to call their own. Roman Mars and Sam Greenspan from the podcast 99% Invisible bring us the story.
There's this 80s movie that I have a real soft spot for. I saw it in the theater, in fact. Now I get to show it to my kids. It's a good one, which is a good thing, because when your kids like a movie, you end up watching it over and over again. It's called The Never-Ending Story.
The Never-Ending Story? What's that?
The Never-Ending Story is a tale of a boy adventurer named
Atreyu!
He and his luck dragon named
Luka!
Are trying to save the world from the onslaught of a terrible force called
Look, Atreyu, the nothing!
But this story also takes place inside of a book that's being read by a present-day boy. A boy named
Bastion?
Pretty much all the dialogue in the movie is written with exclamation points. Anyway, so Bastion the reader realizes that he is actually written into the story, and it's up to him to save the storybook world.
Maybe he doesn't know what he has to do! What do I have to do?
Bastion winds up defeating the nothing, spoiler alert, by giving the empress of the fantasy world a new name.
He has to give me a new name. He's already chosen it. He just has to call it out.
It's really hard to hear, but he names her Moonchild there. I didn't know that for like 20 years. The power of one child's imagination saves an entire world. Seriously, it's a great movie. Anyway, there is a reason why I'm telling you this story. I want you to hold on to that idea that a name can defeat a nothing. Okay, with that in mind, here's our producer, Sam Greenspan.
Hey, Roman.
All right, everyone in listener land. Names versus nothings.
When I was a kid growing up in South Florida, there was this beautiful green place where I always wanted to go play. It looked perfect for a kid to run around and throw a ball. It was a flat mowed lawn that just stretched into infinity. but my parents wouldn't ever take me there.
Yeah, but with good reason.
It was inside of a giant highway interchange. My five-year-old self would never have been able to convince my parents that this would be a good place to play, because no responsible parent takes their kid to play catch off the side of I-95. But I don't think I would even have known how to ask them to take me there, because this place isn't really anywhere that we think of as being a place. There's no name for it.
Let's call it a nothing.
As a kid, I couldn't look away from these perfect grassy areas. But as I grew up and became a driver, I learned to ignore them like everyone else.
So what happens when you give that nothing a name?
That's totally what I'm doing, giving things a name.
So this is my friend Graham.
My name is Graham Carell Allen.
Graham's an artist in Baltimore, and he has this project where he's trying to categorize and classify all the different kinds of invisible public spaces that we overlook. He published a field guide for how to spot them. It's part of a bigger project called New Public Sites.
New Public Sites is an investigation into some of the invisible sites and overlooked features of our everyday public spaces within cities that are not traditionally framed as public space. It's important to name these places because by giving these places succinct and fun and poetic names, we can help start a discourse about our public spaces and how we want to envision them for the future. I'm reminded of the never-ending story. Bastion, you must give me a name.
Call my name!
See?
Graham gives these tours where he puts this language to use, describing incredibly boring pieces of the Baltimore landscape.
This is the first site along the tour, and here we have a void. I remember the building that used to stand here. It was painted blue. Passing through it, you can imagine how us as ghosts, should the building be standing here, would have to actually be invisible to pass through these walls. And now it's the reverse. The building is the ghost, and we're passing through its walls.
So Graham is really giving a tour of a vacant lot.
Vacant lot is one way to put it, but notice what Graham called it.
A void.
And if you pull up his book that Graham published, sort of a field guide to these new public sites, you'll see... All right, hang on. Okay, I don't have the book handy, but here it is as a PDF. I'm going to do Command-F, V-O-I-D. Okay, page 14. Void. A framed open space imbued with the psychic presence of a former mass...
And or the profound immersion of seductively infinite nothingness.
That certainly is a something. To find out more about these invisible public spaces, Graham and Sam rode bikes to the edge of East Baltimore to look at a few, like the one Sam pined for as a kid.
It looks like there's a small parting that we can actually see through. Right now we're at the foot of a small embankment that's probably 15 feet tall or so. We're going to walk up to the edge of this embankment and meet a low-lying concrete wall that will safely separate us from the clover leaf of traffic. Right beyond this this on-ramp onto, we'll be able to hopefully actually look into a freeway eddy. So let's do that right now. So right now we're darting across the street during a huge lull in traffic.
So we're looking at, there's this curved highway exit ramp coming in front of us, and it's maybe about 15 feet, 20 feet ahead of us. There's kind of this almost like a wilderness area. Fenced in, says no trespassing by Maryland Transportation Authority.
Correct.
With the invisible public space in sight, Graham turns to his field manual.
Freeway eddy, an interstitial fragment of space between intersecting curves of highway pavement.
And there you have it. That grassy non-place I'd always wanted to hang out in as a kid now has a name, a freeway eddy.
Graham's field guide to new public sites is full of new identities for these kind of places.
So here we have median refuge, a liminal zone of linear respite between parallels of churning traffic. Enlightened elevation, supple terrain providing the ideal incline from which one may gaze from a wise viewing distance.
Monumental isolation.
Big loose parts, movable materials that invite playful reconfiguration. It is actually an architectural term. Big, loose parts. It's a pretty fun-sounding term, if you ask me.
Parallax of transit.
Triangle crossing. A three-sided concrete platform or asphalt zone providing solace for street-crossing pedestrians.
I don't see too many pedestrians.
We have aural saturation. The overwhelming occupation of a surrounding soundscape by sight-generated droning noise. Median refuge, a liminal
pause zone. Of restraint.
Empty signifier, a post or pole absent of its original sign and or meaning.
Sears node, soil horizon.
If there's a common theme connecting these sites, it's that they're mostly the empty, leftover spaces from car-centered city planning. And it's an odd celebration of these nothing places. Listen to how Graham describes them.
Beauty, beauty, beauty that one can enjoy. Spectacular and sublime, quite beautiful. This is a really beautiful spot. We're actually standing right now in a long strip of sunlight that is created by the space between these two elevated highways. We're at the Chinatown bus stop across the street from the Baltimore Travel Plaza, miles outside of the city. Perhaps the most unglamorous way to enter Baltimore, and yet it's a gateway for hundreds a week, and it's a quite beautiful space. What we're
here's where I gotta draw the line, Graham, because there's some trees, there's some birds, you know, there's, I guess, some intent of landscaping this area around here, but I mean, it's basically a big parking lot with some trucks with diesel gas across the street. There's a subway. There's a bus stop. What are your grounds for calling this beautiful?
Let's be clear here. You can call that grassy patch off the highway a freeway eddy all you want, but I'm not going to take my kids to play ball in one. A highway exit ramp, by any other name, is still just as unattractive and dangerous.
This is beautiful because it's a space that's shared by so many, and yet it was completely undesigned. This space was designed as a parking lot, and it's become this huge nexus for people coming in and out of Baltimore. And so it's not necessarily what it looks like, it's more about what it represents.
Yeah, there's no denying that the experience of being in these new public sites is actually pretty terrible. But for Graham, the beauty is in their potential.
Sometimes everyday unremarkable spaces can become something more simply by virtue of people being there.
It's worth noting here that Zuccotti Park in New York City, the birthplace of the Occupy movement, was a privately owned space and not a public park. So if your goal is finding new spaces for engaged democracy to happen, as it is for Graham, then you need a way to redefine the places in your neighborhood where that kind of activity can happen.
And I think that's important, not to fetishize public spaces as only existing in town squares or Yosemite or Yellowstone or something like this. Not just the National Mall in D.C., for example, but any place. Our everyday public spaces, you know, the spaces that we all share, it's everywhere and we all have access to it. These spaces are the places where this happens. It doesn't just happen over the internet. It happens in physical spaces. New public sites are these physical spaces that we can appropriate, that we can make our own. If it's only for a temporary, you know, demonstration, then so be it. But maybe it's for a farmer's market. Maybe it's for a community garden. Maybe it's simply for a playground or a place where we need to add a few benches to make it a better bus stop. But nevertheless, there's potential there, and by giving it a name and by starting that conversation, we can kind of get these ideas moving into reality.
So it all comes back to a name against a nothing. When you give a nothing a name, you can reimagine it as a something.
If we can create terms for these otherwise invisible experiences and places and things that we all share, that we all of us share in these public spaces, these new public sites, then it's a starting point. It's a starting point for that conversation. By giving it a term, we can then talk about it, and we all know what we're talking about. Then that's the first step. The second step is envisioning, okay, well, how does this need to be improved? And the third step is, how do we do that?
The naming is where it starts. I don't know if I'd name anything Moonchild, though.
And that was Roman Mars and Sam Greenspan from the podcast 99% Invisible. And you can find more about the new Public Sites project by following our link. It's at wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for your listening time today. There is much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. And you can listen to the show anytime with the Word of Mouth podcast. You'll find it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And do us a favor, if you like the podcast, please rate it on iTunes. It helps others find it when shared by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back tomorrow at 2 on NHPR.